Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
On average, the nation's corn growers by this time should have about 15% of the crop in the ground. And where are we as we start this week?
Just 7% complete.
And the reason in most places, very simple.
Too cool and too wet.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey looking at the major Midwest corn states.
We see most of the states reporting less than 5% planting progress. Illinois, just 2% planted. Five-year average is 21%. Iowa also at 2% planted versus 15% on average.
Corn growers in Minnesota haven't been able to get any corn planted at all. And Rippey says the worst part of this is that as far as the bad planting weather,
we certainly don't see any relief on the way. In fact, we're expecting some freezes later this week across the Great Lakes region into the Northeast.
Gary Crawford, Washington.
This is Agriculture Today.
As we kick off this process, we are in an unprecedented time to write a farm bill.
That's the ranking member, Senate Ag Committee from Arkansas, John Bozeman, at the first Senate Farm Bill field hearing.
Just think about the issues that we are confronting. They truly are daunting. A receding pandemic, a brutal war in the breadbasket of Europe, record high inflation, record high fertilizer and input costs, high crop prices, high food costs, labor shortages, drought, delayed planting and transportation and supply chain bottlenecks. The pandemic and Russia's unprovoked invasion of Ukraine have exposed the vulnerabilities of our domestic and international supply chains. This requires us to rethink the nature of our relationships across the globe, strengthening bonds with countries who share similar values, and minimize reliance on those who violate norms. We have an opportunity in this farm bill to ensure we have in place the tools necessary to make American agriculture the trusted supplier for global markets.
That first farm bill hearing in Michigan, the home state of the chairwoman, Debbie Stabenow.
The good news is that our farmers have seen commodity prices go up, but that's been offset by rising costs of fertilizer and other essential inputs that they need to do their business. Our next farm bill must address the economic security of our farmers, our families, and our rural communities by supporting a more resilient and sustainable food supply chain. We can do more to improve competition, expand opportunities for small, mid-sized, and local producers that grow things at home to prevent shortages and reduce cost spikes when a crisis occurs. And we have to acknowledge that the climate crisis is real and that we're seeing it every day in Michigan. It worries me greatly that the Great Lakes are now warming faster than the oceans and that Lake Superior is one of the top five fastest warming lakes in the world, which threatens cold water fishing and a whole lot of other things. Fortunately, Michigan farmers are already stepping up to address the climate crisis, and we need to help them do more. We've seen the overwhelming popularity of voluntary conservation programs. In the Regional Conservation Partnership Program, which I created in the 2014 Farm Bill, for example, local leaders are leveraging federal dollars to expand conservation practices, and our leading researchers at Michigan State and beyond are collaborating with farmers to help them adapt to the severe changes in the weather.
And in his concluding remarks, Bozeman said,
Farm Bill programs and investments not only help American farmers continue to do what they've always done, provide the most abundant, lowest cost, and safest food supply in the world, they also help the developing world. I have no doubt that our farmers and ranchers can meet the moment if given the right tools and the right conditions. The Farm Bill is our opportunity to do that. I'm excited to learn about the diversity and want to hear about the needs of Michigan's farmers and rural communities. What's working for you in your operations? What isn't? How can we make things easier for you to access the programs that we've created? How can USDA be a partner to help strengthen your communities? Are the things the federal government is doing, what are the things that we're doing that's helping you? How can we protect and bolster the vital farm safety net? Over the next year and a half, I look forward to hearing from all of you who are touched by USDA, our farmers, large and small, organic and conventional, our ranchers, our forest land owners, sportsmen and women, rural community leaders, and those assisted by our nutrition programs, which are so very important. These perspectives are critically important to ensure that we get this right.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
To gain a feel for the potential disruptions, we first look at what the trade was before the Ukraine-Russia conflict in 2019.
University of Illinois ag economist Dr. Gary Schnittke.
Major users of nitrogen fertilizer were China, which was the number one user at 27 million tons, by far the largest user of nitrogen. That was followed by India and then the United States. The fourth largest user was Brazil. The producers of nitrogen were first China, and that China produced enough to meet their needs in terms of nitrogen for agricultural use. The next largest producers were India and the United States. That was followed by Russia with 11 million tons of production. Overall, the major net exporters of nitrogen in 2019 were Russia first, with 15% of the net exports. That was followed by China, Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait. So the major net exporter of nitrogen was Russia, and it would be very difficult to make up that difference if Russia would completely go off the line. The major importers of nitrogen was first India and then followed by Brazil, and Brazil imported almost all of its nitrogen use. That was then followed by United States and France. If we look at potential disruptions from the Ukraine-Russia war, we first look to Russia. There is a potential that Russian supplies of nitrogen to the world could be reduced either because of the war itself or because of sanctions placed on Russia. The second area where we could see reductions is the European Union or Western Europe. That area was largely self-sufficient in nitrogen production before the war, but they have a stated goal of reducing natural gas imports from the Russian Federation. Russia provides 40% of the natural gas needs of the EU. If that is cut, at the very least, nitrogen from that area will be relatively high compared to other sources and will likely have to be curtailed so that Europe's heating needs can be met. The third area where we could see reductions from are areas that could provide natural gas to European Union but are now using that to produce nitrogen. One of the prime examples of that would be Norway. Those are the areas where it could be cut. If we're looking at the impacts of that, particularly on the Western Hemisphere and Brazil, Brazil will have to look for new sources of nitrogen. Currently, it gets about 20% of its nitrogen from Russia, and it could look to China, Kuwait, Algeria, or Iran for the additional nitrogen. Those happen to be current major suppliers to Brazil. They could also look in the Western Hemisphere, for example, at Trinidad and Tobago, which currently provides U.S. with nitrogen fertilizers, as well as Canada. Brazil could use Canada as a source of nitrogen, as well as the United States. All of that is going to draw nitrogen away from the United States and move that into Brazil. Depending on the size of the disruptions in Russia, Western Europe, and areas around Western Europe, we could see much higher nitrogen prices in the fall as we're moving forward into the planting season for 2023 crops.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Thank you all for inviting me here today to discuss the food system, the sheer challenges we face to ensure that food is produced and delivered safely, responsibly, and reliably in the United States as well as around the world.
Dave McLennan is CEO of Cargill, testifying recently before the House Ag Committee.
The food system has been remarkably resilient through the challenges of the last 2 years. We face an ongoing pandemic, extreme weather conditions, and global disruptions. Still, food shortages have been rare, and we've maintained good supplies due to the essential work of those in the sector. My name is Dave McLennan, and I am the CEO of Cargill. Cargill is 155,000 people working across the globe to nourish the world in a safe, responsible, and sustainable way. Our operations are broad. We bring together people, ideas, and resources to deliver products, technology, and ways of operating that build successful businesses and communities. We produce a range of edible oils used in restaurants and home cooking, as well as ingredients for food and beverage companies. We provide bio-based solutions across industries, including construction materials, paints, and beauty products. We support better animal health and nutrition with feed and premix options. We help farmers finance their operations, manage risk, and improve their soil. And we process beef, turkey, value-added meats, and egg products for retail, food service, and processing customers. We also innovate by producing alternative proteins, including plant-based proteins. Today, I am here to talk about North American Protein, one of Cargill's many businesses. It is headquartered in Wichita, Kansas, and it employs more than 28,000 people in 19 states. We operate facilities, distribution centers, feed mills, and hatcheries in rural communities across the U.S. The jobs that Cargill employees do every day in these facilities put protein on the family table for millions of Americans. We recognize their contributions with competitive compensation and benefits like on-site medical care, nearby wellness clinics, and housing support. We increased base pay significantly over the past 2 years to recognize the critical role that they play during COVID and as frontline workers. We acknowledge that the rising price of many goods, including food, poses significant challenges for consumers worldwide. The price for meat is not immune to the global factors that are causing inflation. Supply and demand, labor constraints, transportation challenges, and rising feed costs add even greater pressure, and it all leads to increased prices at retail. Meatpacking is a complex and cyclical business. The size and scale of our operations provides the agility to help mitigate volatility and ensure that food is efficiently brought from farm to table. We are providing a consistent food supply and strengthening the resilience of the food system to mitigate disruptions. We are actively hiring to reduce labor shortages, increasing wages and benefits for employees, and investing in our plants so that they are run as efficiently and as safely as possible. We welcome competition to the industry and support the dynamics of a free market. We believe in price transparency and fair open markets. In our North American protein business, for example, Cargill consistently purchases a third of our cattle on a cash basis.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I know that many of our producers here today are anxious about getting into the fields, but we're seeing an abnormally cold and wet planting season. And I appreciate your willingness to be here today and talk about the challenges you're facing and show how the Farm Bill can continue to provide important support.
Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow, chairwoman of the Senate Ag Committee, at their first 2023 Farm Bill field hearing.
You know, when we began to plan the hearing, it was an easy decision, as I said, to hold it at Michigan State University. The building we're sitting in is a prime example of the kind of innovation I encouraged in my Timber Innovation Act, which was included in the last Farm Bill. And it's the first mass timber building in Michigan showcasing technology that creates jobs while using a renewable building material that also stores carbon. And my colleague and friend who is with me today, John Bozeman from Arkansas, knows something about timber as well. Over half the state of Arkansas is covered by forest land, and forest products are incredibly important, I know, to his state's economy as well. And this is an important area that we're excited to work on together. Senator Bozeman is the Republican leader on the committee. He brings the important perspective of Arkansas farmers, ranchers, and forest landowners.
And she says this is a bipartisan effort.
Having Senator Bozeman here today and holding our next field hearing in Senator Bozeman's home state is more than just symbolic for us. Farm bills happen only once every 5 years and demonstrate a tradition of bipartisanship that has become rare in today's Congress. Our most recent farm bill passed with the strongest bipartisan support ever. We want to do even better. This hearing represents a commitment to continue that bipartisanship and build an even stronger coalition of stakeholders for the 2023 Farm Bill.
She's quick to remind that the Farm Bill touches every family.
Many people aren't aware of the broad impact the Farm Bill has on our Michigan bottom line. I've always said we don't have an economy unless somebody makes something and somebody grows something. And that's what we do in Michigan. Agriculture contributes 1 in 4 Michigan jobs, and only California grows more different kinds of crops than Michigan. I like the way the dean said it better. I usually joke, who cares about California? But that is a joke for the national press that are here. That is a joke. So, but just look around the room and at our witnesses today. The Farm Bill impacts producers in so many different crops and commodities, forest landowners, thriving businesses. And whether you're a dairy farmer worried about fair trade with our neighbors in Canada or expanding farmers markets in communities across the state, the Farm Bill serves producers of all types, big and small, new and beginning, family farmers, veteran farmers, rural and urban. It helps small businesses thrive, meets important needs for rural communities like things like high-speed internet and healthcare facilities, and makes sure Americans put healthy food on the table thanks to strong food and nutrition policies. And the Farm Bill provides tools to protect our Great Lakes, ensuring we can keep our land and water clean for hunting and fishing and outdoor recreation, which is at the core of our Michigan way of life. We've seen unprecedented challenges since the last Farm Bill was passed in 2018. The pandemic exposed vulnerabilities in our farm and food economy, as we know. Farmers were whiplashed by low prices and breakdowns in processing, while Americans across the board saw empty shelves and skyrocketing prices. And just as our country has been recovering now economically, Putin's war in Ukraine is threatening the worldwide food supply.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
That's something that is so obvious to us as farmers and ranchers that we feel like it goes without saying.
Ken Brackett is an Idaho cattlewoman on the concept of taking care of the land so it takes care of you.
But we have to remember again that rural-urban divide. There's so many people that don't understand animal agriculture. They don't understand livestock production. They don't understand that if we were making poor management decisions about the health of our ecosystems, that we would lose our ranch. We would be out of business. So it's continuing to get engaged in those discussions and making sure people understand that what we're doing is sustainable, both environmentally and economically.
Now, she admits new technology does have a place in the sustainability story.
I'm always talking about the fact that this sustainability narrative is being written and driven by people who don't understand the cattle industry. They don't understand livestock production. However, there are so many opportunities for us to collaborate because we truly do have a lot of the same goals, right? We have the same goals. We want to, I'm in Idaho, so we talk a lot about rangeland health. We want to improve rangeland health. We have sage grouse. We want to increase sage grouse habitat. So we have the same goals. And I think it's really important that we as cattle producers understand that in order to be successful in combating that sustainable narrative that's coming out of mainstream media, and actually, what we need to do is collaborate. We need to reach out to some of these. There's a lot of friendly conservation groups who are willing to put dollars on the ground and help create some of these. It might be wildlife habitat programs or projects. There's a lot of opportunity for collaboration in this area. So I would really encourage producers to think about reach out of our silo, see who we can talk to and kind of bridge that gap. And let's make the sustainability effort broader. You mentioned new technologies. There are so many innovative technologies going on right now. I wish that some of those would get traction in mainstream media. The success story we have with the technologies from cow-calf all the way through each segment of our supply chain.
She testified recently before Congress and explains there are impressive improvements in sustainability.
I can talk most intelligently about technologies at the cow-calf level, and I will dive into that. But I would be remiss if I didn't point out the feed efficiency at our feedlot level. They have done such tremendous work in that area that definitely pertains to sustainability and the footprint that the cattle industry has across the country. So that would be a leading technology that I feel like gets a bad rap. Technology at the cow-calf level, some of the fun stuff stuff. Some of the interesting things that we have used is geofencing, the GPS collars. It's a new application of targeted grazing. So we don't have to go and fence our pastures into very small paddocks. We don't have to use electric fencing. You can use this geofencing technology, which is really exciting. It allows us to move the cattle into specific areas. Perhaps we're trying to stop an invasive annual grass and we want to graze that area before the grass goes to seed, for example. So that's a lot of fun. Some of the other technology is GIS, being able to do our monitoring using like Google Earth technology and taking data from smaller plot points, from monitor plot points, and having the capability to extrapolate that data to a much larger area has been a godsend for me, being able to reduce my time spent on monitoring on these federal lands. So those are two really fun ones. Great thing for me is my kids are excited about this technology. So it's getting them more involved and wanting to be on the ranch and be more involved in that sustainability aspect as well.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
My name is Donnie King, and I've been a Tyson team member for almost 40 years.
King, the CEO of Tyson, testifying recently on cattle markets in front of the House Ag Committee.
I started in Pine Bluff, Arkansas as an hourly team member on the production floor and now proudly serve as president and chief executive officer. In our business, unprecedented market shocks have created an extraordinary strain across our operations and the global supply chain. This has reduced our ability to produce beef at sufficient quantities to meet record high consumer demand. Starting in early 2020, the pandemic impacted our ability to operate production facilities at full capacity. This was due in part to protocols we put in place to keep team members safe. We required our team members to stay home with pay if they were sick, tested positive, or were close contacts. We also had team members who stayed home to take care of their children and loved ones. In our beef business, these factors made it difficult to process all the cattle available on the market. This drove down the demand and prices for live cattle. At the same time, demand for beef skyrocketed as restaurants closed and Americans started cooking more meals at home. Simply put, production could not meet the consistently strong demand. Economists have agreed with this assessment, which underscores that the market, not Tyson, sets the price for cattle and beef. When a product is in oversupply, in this case, live cattle, the law of supply and demand drives down the prices for that product. And when a product is in strong demand, in this case beef, the same law of supply and demand drives up prices for that product. Today, the situation is deepened by geopolitical issues, which are creating shortages of essential inputs such as grain. This results in higher costs, which is reflected in the prices American families pay at the grocery store. Some incorrectly suggest that the rise in beef prices is due to the consolidation of the beef industry, but the data doesn't support this claim. The concentration of the industry for commercial cattle among the four processors here today is 69% and has been virtually unchanged over the past 30 years. And in most of those 30 years, the profit margins of ranchers and cattle producers have been much higher than the low single-digit margins we made as beef processors. In fact, in several years, ranchers made a historic profit on live cattle while Tyson either lost money or barely broke even. This, too, is the market at work. It is important to note that Tyson returns are not solely the result of prices customers pay. Other factors contribute, including the mix of products we sell, the costs associated with regulations, operating more sustainably, and our efforts to compete for labor. Today, Americans are demanding higher quality and variety, as well as convenience, and our customers are willing to pay for these across the food chain, benefiting both cattle producers and beef processors. We're also working hard to become a more efficient business by investing in automation and innovation. This not only results in a safer workplace, but also drives down operational costs, which in turn allows us to keep costs down for our customers and further invest in our team members and our business. In places like Bowling Green, Kentucky, Macon, Georgia, and Humboldt, Tennessee, we are increasing production capacity and creating thousands of new jobs. Today, these jobs pay an average of $24 an hour, including full retirement and medical benefits, or approximately $50,000 a year. Today, Tyson Foods operates in communities spanning 30 states. In these communities, we invest more than $15 billion every year with over 11,000 independent farmers and ranchers who supply us with the cattle, pig, chickens, and turkeys that we need.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Round two of the U.S.-United Kingdom Dialogue for Atlantic Trade got underway this week in Aberdeen, Scotland.
Yesterday, we kicked off the second dialogue in Aberdeen by sampling some of Scotland's proudest food and drink and one of the U.K.'s biggest exports, Scotch whiskey.
Notable, according to U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai, as our nation is the world leader in Scotch whiskey imports. While a new agreement on Section 232 tariffs on steel and aluminum is allowing U.S. whiskey and other food and farm goods to enter the U.K. The two-day event will feature a format similar to the first dialogue in Baltimore, Maryland.
We will hear from a wide range of stakeholders and how we can ensure our trade relationship creates broad-based economic opportunity while meeting the challenges of the 21st century. And we will visit some of the most innovative and exciting businesses in the United Kingdom.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.